Welcome to Conductor's Brew. We are back with another Beethoven show. Brandon's here. Matt's here. We're in the front yard. And we got tea today.
We do.
We're branching out a little bit with our brew. We still haven't gotten to the beer yet. Well, no, McKeever had a beer that one day.
But yeah.
That wasn't a shared experience. We're not going to count that. But we're branching out the tea today. So, Matt, tell us about this tea.
All right. We are drinking Pu'er tea.
Pu'er.
P-U-E-R-H.
P-U-E-R-H.
Yes.
Now, is this a type of a leaf? Like a type of... Tell me what that means.
So I will tell you. I hope you're ready.
We're prepared.
As Sam Jackson would say, hold on to your butts.
Okay, fair enough.
So the tea plant is an interesting thing. The concept of tea. You asked a simple question. I'm going to give you a very convoluted, long answer.
Oh, well, thank you. Okay. That's what I expect.
My obsession with tea has been going on for years now, and
you used to have a brew of the day on Facebook.
Yeah,
right?
I still do that every now and then, but okay. I've kind of hedged away from the book of the face for a while now.
Oh yeah,
it's just a bit too depressing.
Fair
days.
Enough. Yeah. No, this is not a great
time
for social media.
So to get back to something a little bit more lighthearted, which is tea. There's really only one kind of tea, and that is the tea plant tea. Everything else is a tincture.
What?
Or tonic. Right, so when you drink herbal tea,
okay,
they have to call it herbal tea because tea is made from the leaves of the tea plant.
Okay.
All right, technically speaking, right? So if you have chamomile or like rose tea or hibiscus tea, it's not really tea. It's a tincture. All right, so that's number one. Number two is the tea leaves themselves are really infinitely customizable. So you can process them in any number of ways to get different results in the tea leaf itself, the dried product that you then sell as tea.
Uh-huh.
So there's like three main categories of tea, four really. There's tea that's picked, the leaves are picked really early on, and that becomes white tea because the leaves are really pale in color, and the tea itself is really light color. Then there's green tea, which is mature leaves, fully green, usually fully grown leaves that you pick and you preserve, and so it stays green. And then there's black tea, which they pick the same old green tea leaves, except they bruise them. They bruise them and they let them oxidize. So the blackness is this oxidization. It's the air getting to the leaves.
Okay.
Yeah. And then they cure it, and that's a different kind of tea. And then you can take any of those, basically, and ferment them. But the most common one to ferment is black tea.
Okay.
And when you do that, and you stick it in a bundle and you steam it, and then you let it sit for months or years, that changes the character of the tea. It gets like these interesting kind of candy or fruity or earthy tones to it. And we're drinking a fermented tea today. It's kind of a traditional Chinese tea that you can infuse over and over and over and over again because it's just so potent. But it's not overly strong or bitter. It has this really refined kind of earthy, I call it a wet dock flavor.
Yeah.
It smells and tastes like a wet dock on the ocean.
And having grown up on the coast, I know what that smells like.
Brandon, you seem to indicate that you thought it smelled like a dock also.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm right back at the ocean with this.
Yeah.
Just throw some barnacles in there, we're all set.
The color is wonderful. It's like this rusty brown, almost a maroon, almost a purple.
Kind of a caramely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's wonderfully delicious. I do taste that kind of that salty thing, and it's on a chilly day. It definitely does the trick.
Oh, it really touches the soul.
Yeah,
indeed it does.
Oh, it really gets me.
Man, this podcast got everything.
I could just smell it all day and be happy. I don't need to drink
right.
it. It's just so it smells so good.
That's right.
It's got a lot of umami in it.
There you go. Yeah, not it doesn't taste like turkey, but it's
no turkey.
No turkey on this one. Ooh, I got some tea leaves. I could read my tea leaves.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah.
I don't know what it means, but I have brown specks in my future. Whatever that means.
Okay. I guess technically tea is a tincture as well.
So what is a tincture? It's like just like you grind up something and brew it?
A tincture is anything, any item, any herb or like peel or something that's had its essential oils extracted.
Okay.
Yeah. Usually hot water.
Well, give me another hit of this
this
tincture here, and we'll get started with our Beethoven. So, you got to strain it there.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I do this in the big mason jar and just strain it. Loose leaf tea only.
All right. There you go.
Do you need any more over there?
I'm still good.
Okay.
All right. Well, let's get this show on the road. We're up to Beethoven 8 today, fellas. And this one is, this one's like four, not done terribly often.
No.
Which is a mistake, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And I have done this one recently.
I went to your concert, Larry.
You did. You did. You were in on that experience. And this is one that is it's fascinating to me when it shows up in Beethoven's output. Coming late, you know, it's, you know, almost to the end there, but it sounds like it could have just come right after two.
It does.
You know, it sounds so classical, and in terms of its scope, it's not very long. It's 30 minutes maybe,
something like that. Yeah.
And it's got a much tighter structure in terms of following the classical style. But it's got all the force and power of Beethoven in his mature voice. Mm. All of the innovations in terms of thematic development, all of that's there, of course. But he's kind of just going back to his roots and going back to what he learned from Haydn in terms of that more tight, high classical kind of a structure. At least that's the way I see it, you know. There's different reads of it, I suppose. But anyway, I find this one is kind of a fascinating one. Coming between the ball of energy that is seven and the monumental ninth. We have this little nice palate cleanser, if you will, of a symphony. This wasn't the slim Greek maiden that you made reference to a few weeks ago, Brandon, was it? We were talking about four.
That was four.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this could also be a slim Greek maiden. What do you think?
I think so.
Between the two Norse gods or whatever.
Yeah.
I think seven's probably more of like a...
Technically, Schumann was talking about that.
But that's Schumann.
I did He's kind of weird. Him in that sense.
You what?
I did mention that it was him, so...
Oh, yes.
I guess I was talking about that.
Yeah. Schumann's thing. Anyway, okay. So let's dive into this. This opening just, you know, boom, starts off right into the Allegro. Unlike seven, we don't have a monumental, gigantic wind-up. It's just boom.
No introduction
into
at all.
Just straight away. I don't know what to make of that. Didn't feel like he needed to wind up for the party.
You know, Beethoven sounds tired to me sometimes.
Yeah?
I think he was like, yeah, I've got this thing, you know, in my head. It's just sort of bumping around in there. Let's just get it down on paper.
Yeah.
So he skipped the introduction.
Let's just get this going.
I don't know. That's I totally made that up. But.
You know, it's a good a theory as any, I suppose. I don't know. But
it is sort of... This symphony, its character to me is sort of sardonic, sort of sarcastic, sort of witty. Definitely has its quirky, funny moments,
mm-hmm.
and it's full of strange contrasts, dynamics especially, and rhythmic contrasts as well. But more on that later.
Okay, more on that later. All right, good deal.
Yeah, but speaking of time and rhythm,
okay,
the tempo.
Yeah,
not the tempo. Excuse me, the time signature.
Yeah,
you mentioned that this sounded like it could come after two.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only other symphony that starts in three.
There you go. Interesting.
Three. Right.
Yeah. I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good point.
Wouldn't stake my life on it. But
yeah.
Sitting here thinking about it.
Yeah. All the others are. Wait, how many of them have introductions? One, two, four. Well, I guess not all of them.
Three,
have
if you count the dun.
Count the two beats.
Count the two chords.
No, that's true. It is sort of introduction.
not really.
But I mean, five doesn't. Five is the obvious one. Mm-hmm. Six doesn't have an introduction either. Seven has a long one. We talked about that last week. And nine doesn't either, does it? Just gets right into it.
Mm-hmm.
But this one really starts with a bang.
Yeah.
I mean, literally a bang.
Yeah. I love this introduction. It's one of my favorite parts of this whole thing.
It's rowdy.
Yeah, it is rowdy.
Larry, I want to ask you a question.
Sure.
About, since you just recently did this.
Yeah.
Recently being last year.
Yeah.
What did your musicians think about it?
Well, you know, we talked, first of all, a lot of them, most of them hadn't played it before, or it'd been a long time since they had done it.
Interesting.
And so their feeling was like, you know, which is mine, is like, why doesn't this get played very often?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. Oh, we got a big fire truck coming. We're going to pause here for a second.
Woo-hoo!
That's the long one.
Yeah.
It's got two steering wheels on it.
Oh, it's the ladder. Yeah. It's the ladder.
Big
Look
ladder.
At that.
Ladder truck.
It's the big one.
Which way is he going? This way or that
He's
way?
He's coming straight down the hill.
All right.
Here we go.
Woo-hoo.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are the steering wheels in that. There's a guy back there.
There's a guy in the back.
He's got to steer those back tires.
Yeah.
Look at that. All right. What's that? Well, you know, for truck interruptions, that was probably one of the more interesting
that
ones
was we've awesome.
Had. At least it's not just another random FedEx truck.
Should have got their opinion on Beethoven.
Guys, there's a big, the Salt Lake City tall ladder truck.
Tall ladder.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was it.
That's the kind that goes in the parade.
I wonder where it was up here. We don't have any huge buildings up here, do we?
No. There's no, the tallest building is LDS Hospital up there. But that's on the other side of the neighborhood. So like, I don't know. All right. Well, anyway, that's interesting.
They would need that ladder to get into your place.
I only live on the fourth floor.
Christmas lights in the cemetery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All righty. Well, anyway, that was random but fun.
Yeah, that was
okay.
Good.
But I think we could call that about a lot of things in the podcast. The podcast is random but fun. All right. You're asking about what my players thought.
What your players thought about it? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's like, you know, this is because we had done 7 not long before that, and we had done 5 not long before that. You know, so they were, you know, quite familiar with Beethoven's, you know, his symphonies and his output. And they're like, yeah, this is really classical. And this is definitely something that is, doesn't seem like it would be his second to last symphony.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't sound like it at all. Yeah. I remember coming to this symphony very late. It was not one that I'd ever really listened to until I think I bought that Leonard Bernstein New York Philharmonic recording where it just happened to be on the same record as like the 9th or 7th or something.
Yeah.
No, it was on 6. It was 6 and 8 together, which was interesting.
I think I've got that recording, yeah.
Yeah, it's great, yeah. But I actually had heard the second movement years before that in high school. This is kind of a strange story. So I went to a private all-boys Catholic high school in Middletown, Connecticut.
Yeah.
And
that explains a lot.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks. I knew I was opening a can of worms there.
Hey, I went to Catholic school, too. Mine was co-ed, but, you know. Still.
You know, we had a sister school right down the road. So,
oh, it's one
yeah,
of those.
We just had to get creative.
It sounds like the plot of a bad summer movie, you know.
It is. It was for a lot of us.
An 80s, 80s
years
summer
of bad
movie.
Summer movie, yeah.
All right.
But no, we have to take a religion class.
Yes,
I've and heard. Part of this religion class, every once a week, I think we would do like these, you know, reflections or journal entries or something, and the priest would collect them. Who was the teacher? He would collect them and comment on them. And it was,
God.
Looking in retrospect, it's a little odd to do that. But anyway,
that sounds horrible.
No, he was a nice guy actually. He wasn't a priest at the time. He was a deacon and. In the Greek Orthodox Church, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Really, really nice guy, actually. I learned a lot from him. Not necessarily about religion, but... anyway, he would play music during these reflection sessions. And he would play the second movement of this symphony.
Really?
I had no clue it was Beethoven. And I knew Beethoven. I thought I knew Beethoven.
Yeah.
And the second movement does not sound like Beethoven.
No.
It sounds like a mix between...
Yep.
Well, it does sound like Beethoven now that I know it. But it's. I thought it could have been Haydn... Maybe
yeah, I thought it was Haydn.
Yeah, yeah, it's good. It could be Haydn.
It does have this like
yeah,
almost music box quality kind of dance. I don't know. That's kind of how I hear it. Is like
it's the clock.
Little,
yeah.
It's like a little jingle in a way.
Did the second movement?
Yeah, and it's so short.
Yeah. But I remember being so moved by this, especially the last section in it, in that short second movement, just the overlapping thematic stuff on the pedal. 5 bass. Da, da, dum, ba, ba, bum, ba, ba. I just, it did something to me every time I heard it, and I never knew what it was. And I asked once after class, and the answer I got was, oh, I don't know, it's just off some compilation CD I copied or something. And I'm like, oh, you're killing me.
Random stuff.
So when I imagine my surprise and shock and joy finding this, listening to the 8th Symphony for the first time, to know that it was in a Beethoven symphony.
And you were magically transported back to Catholic school.
Yeah. No, thankfully this has never really reminded me.
That usually
me.
Happens to me in stress dreams. But,
oh, wow. That's weird. You know, I think about it.
I don't have stress dreams
I
about
Catholic
school. I
probably think about that class every time I think about this symphony. Yeah. But anyway,
let's go, can we go back? Let's
yes,
go to the
please.
First
yeah,
movement.
That was, that's all to say.
Yes,
that I came to the symphony late, and
sure.
and it's different than his other stuff.
You know,
that's
where else,
all that. I, that's what I meant.
Besides randomly showing up in Matt's Catholic school class,
yeah.
This second movement also is in the soundtrack to Civilization V, which is one of those strategy games. Sid Meier's, I think, very
I
famous strategy game. You build a country from scratch.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
It's a really good game.
Yeah.
But anyway, they have, unlike some of the other ones where they had like music written purposely for it, they use actual classical music has the soundtrack to the game. Yeah. And one of them was Grand Pianola music. I was nerding out about that several months ago.
The Adams.
Yeah, John Adams. And then this is one that's used in the when you're civilizations in like the 18th and 19th century.
Tick, tick, tick.
This is one of the pieces, that second movement that's in there. So Catholic school and civilization. Five. That's where we use it. Okay, but going back to the first movement.
Yeah.
So this beginning. Now, when I was first rehearsing this with the symphony, I was doing this, rehearsing it slower and doing it in three. And I stayed rehearsing in three and doing it in three for too long. I think it's okay to take it down and to work out some of the stuff in the beginning in three, but then you got to quickly move it into one.
Mm.
So, and I'm one of these people who, like, a lot of times when people say, oh, you have to do it in one as opposed to doing it in two, I'm like, no, you can still keep the tempo going in two. You don't have to do the big beat to make it go faster.
In three?
No, what I'm saying is, like, oftentimes, like, where somebody would maybe take something and put it into one, I'll actually pulse the next level lower.
Oh.
Whether it's in, like, if it's in 2/4, I'll just show two. Or if it's in 3/4, I'll show three. I just make it really small.
I see, yeah.
I feel like I can keep the tempo going.
Yeah.
But what I was saying is with this, I did find it hard to keep the tempo going, even in a fast three.
Mm.
And when I would switch and do it into one, I felt like a lot...
Interesting.
I felt like it rolled a lot better.
It's just something about subdividing it that slows it down.
Yeah, something. It doesn't feel like it would be, but I didn't like it. What I was getting with that. But there are some spots where I think it is good to go into three. At letter B, where it goes to, let me see. I cannot get the second movement in my head. Just for maybe those three measures. You know. Now, you don't have to. You can go, but it might help them out if you pulse that in three. So anyway, that's all to say that, because one of the things we always talk about with this is, like, how do you, what tempo you take and what meter or conducting pattern do you use?
Well, since we're at B, I can tell you how I like to do it.
Yeah.
I take a middle of the road approach, sort of like with the Third Symphony, where there's those hits, the same exact key viola.
Mm-hmm.
They occur so that they feel like it's 2/4 bars, right? So what I do is I'll actually give the first 1, 2, 3, 4. I'll give 4 2/4 bars basically.
So you actually go 1, 2, 1, 2.
But the last one, the fourth one, you can use to go back into three, or rather into one.
Yeah.
So it's just a bigger bigger rebound off that one. Then everybody knows you're back into time.
That feels like it might be tricky for me to do. I don't know. I would think about that, but
yeah, you have to feel comfortable.
I mean, I kind of do that because of the way when I shift into three, I mean, I stay in a three pattern, but I'm accenting bump ba dum bump ba dum. I'm accenting two.
You're already kind of doing
one,
three,
but I'm not going just down up in like a two pattern. So it's sort of a similar thing. But then I think going back into one, dee da dee da 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 dee da. That's good to go into one there. But anyway, that was just a cautionary tale. I stayed in three too long, or did too much of this in three, and I would go back and do it. When I do it again, I'd go back and do more of it in one. So anyway, just a learning from my experience. All right, very good, very energetic opening. Of course, got to take the exposition repeat.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've all agreed on those things at this point. let's see. What else is kind of
thing that's a little tough to get rolling sometimes is in the development, the violas, 1, 2, da-da-dee-da, I found that I had to coach them to really think 2, 3, 4, 1.
There's another moment where three is good.
Yeah.
Ba, beep, ba, beep, ba.
Oh, well, I was going to say the opposite,
show beat
actually.
Two. You're back in
like,
two.
No, I just want to be, I want it to be in one, and I want them to really just feel every eighth note. Da, 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 2, 3, 4, 1, da, 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 da. Yeah.
Okay.
And just keep it going.
I was thinking, like, you should show them that beat two. It might help them place the eighth notes.
I guess, yeah.
1, 2, da, 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 da.
I really only like to do that if it's a strong beat two. In this case, I want each of those eighth notes to feel like it's going into beat one.
Okay.
2, 3, 4, 1. 2, 3, 4, 1 instead of 1. 2, 3, 4, 1. 2-3-4-1.
You know I see what you mean. Yeah.
Like a perfect example of what you're talking about is in the Ninth Symphony, the beginning of the fourth movement, where you can go like 1-2 da 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 da, right? Yeah. But like that's because it's a big accent on B2.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. But I would shift back into one for sure when the woodwinds start bee da 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 dee da 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 in this in the development.
Okay.
So, but I felt like maybe just to start the violas in working in three. Mm. Like I said, I'm rethinking how I'm approaching all the meter and all of this.
A wise teacher once told me, only subdivide if you absolutely have to.
And that's true.
And then my next teacher told me, only subdivide if you absolutely have to. And then my next teacher told me, only subdivide if you absolutely have to. Yeah.
Well, it seems like there's a consistent thing.
Yeah, and it just gets in the way.
Yeah, it does.
No matter your intentions, I think.
I think a lot of times, sometimes people don't subdivide when they could and it would be helpful because they're moving too much. They don't know how to move with economy. And because having a really large rebound or something like that, when you're subdividing, is what's going to slow it down. So you can keep the subdivision going if you... economize the size of your rebounds and stuff like that. And that's what I was thinking. I can do that. I can make that happen. But I still didn't like the result in a lot of spots. So it doesn't always work.
Okay. I think you're right. I think it's all about the context that you use it in and also how you execute it. Like, let's look here. Do you have measure numbers?
I do.
128.
Sforzando. Give me a second.
Yeah. Page. 128, Sforzando downbeat.
Yep.
After fortissimo, four bars.
Yeah.
Same thing as at the beginning of the development where you have this big sforzando hit and then you want the cellos to come in on time on the end of the small beat too. Now that I think about it, I think what I have done and what I am totally fine with is kind of giving a slight release. It looks like a release on beat two.
Yeah.
Where you're just, you're just giving a hit...
Basically showing one and two.
Yes, you're right.
And melding two. Yeah. So it achieves the same thing
I think it's exactly right.
Okay, I think we've come around to an agreement.
I think so.
That's good. That's always nice when we can come to agreement. All right, good. Brandon, any thoughts on this movement?
This, when as soon as I hear it, that first line, it just harkens me back to the sixth symphony. Because, I mean, it's F major. And there's this pastoral quality that kind of just jumps out at me. It feels like I'm right back in the countryside.
Yeah, it's pure joy.
I'm missing is like an English horn or something. It's like an early summer feel.
Yeah.
To this back out in the countryside.
Yeah. It does have this kind of more relaxed feel to it. Yeah. And I also think it's not so monumental of a symphony. It's refreshing.
It is. And I like what you said earlier, that it's kind of a palate cleanser. It really is.
It's got a nice glass of lemonade. Maybe that's a little stretch.
A little country time out there.
Hey, man, fresh squeeze. We're talking Beethoven here.
All right, fresh squeeze. You're
fresh
absolutely right.
Fresh squeeze lemonade. Thank you very much. Okay.
All those German lemons.
What?
All those German lemons.
Germans are famous for their lemons. Everybody knows that. All right.
What? Really?
No.
That's a joke, man.
Oh.
No, that's not. That's my not serious face. Okay, hey, look, three Fs at letter D.
Trigger warning. God.
What?
That joke went right over my head.
Letter D, Larry. Triple forte.
I totally lost my brain train of thought. The big moment.
Oh, I'm totally stuck on that retransition, though.
Okay, you want to go back to that? I had some.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I want to go back to letter C.
All right, that's fine. We'll get to D in a second.
Love the effect that he gets with the varying sforzandi.
Yeah.
They're on different places. Well, four bars before C, it's basses, and then everybody else in the next bar, basses, everybody else in the next bar. And then at C, it changes to beat two first violins. Beat one basses, beat two first violins, and beat two in the next bar wins. And so it's just this really wonderful timbral accents happening in different places. I love pulling that out of the texture. Yeah, and I mean, it happens, but it's got to be like an intentional calling card, if you will, for each of those groups of instruments.
Yeah, I told them the cellos and basses first time they did this. I'm like, yeah, you guys are all by yourself there. That's not a mistake. The first time they're like, oh, sorry, we played in the rest.
Yeah, isn't that something? The seconds and the violas are totally absent until the seconds have that syncopated entrance of the theme that they pick up from the cellos and basses. Mm-hmm. That awesome beat three entrance. That's just, I love those entrances.
With Wait, where are you?
Pardon?
Where are you at?
8 after C.
Oh, okay, 8 after C, I got you, yeah.
And then 8 bars later, then the violas come in and just roaring on this tremolo. And they get to play this cool kind of duet with the seconds underneath everything, keeping the energy going. And then we get into one of my favorite transitions in all of music, where it's just this long 22-measure phrase.
Oh my god, it just goes forever.
It just goes forever.
And like, the thing is, it struggles to keep the energy going up through that. Dun, da, da,
yeah.
Dun,
da,
da, da, da, it's sort of like one long pedal.
Yeah, it is.
Because you just hit and C.
Yep. Yeah, the effect of the bass figures just... I mean, you get the same first and last note in each bar for how many bars. It sounds like a pedal. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
And then he diminishes it all. Dun, dun, shrinks it all down. And then two before D, this... a rising line and the cellos and the bass.
Yes, I mean, and the recapitulation happens in the basses.
Yeah, ba 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 ba.
He inverts it. Yeah, and then the melody. He inverts which instruments.
So that leads me to what I was going to say at D.
Three Fs.
At D. That's the three Fs, right? At D. Yeah, it's in the bassi, the cellos, basses, and the bassoons, and we've got violins. Way up in the stratosphere, mm-hmm. subdividing three Fs, woodwinds, three Fs. Like, I'm like, oh my god, yeah. Like, how loud do the cellos and the basses have to play and the bassoons to make that heard if everybody takes it literally?
Well, it's also
where the trumpets blasting.
I know, it's like so. You, this is where you have to be like, okay, don't take three Fs quite seriously, trumpet horn players, because, like, you know, you're. They can only play so loud.
Yeah,
you know,
it's context, right? It's all relative. It's got to build.
It is interesting though that he would put the melody in the lowest registers.
Oh, what a joke, right?
Yeah,
it's just like, so
what
great.
What the heck? Who would do that? Orchestration teachers would score you out of that.
Well, the thing is, like, you know, if like I said, everybody played that, literally you couldn't hear them. I mean, it's just so screaming loud, and the with the fiddles being so high,
mm-hmm.
with that dynamic marking. And if they did that, literally, it would just drive them out of the way.
I like to have the violins think of that as being a melodic line rather than a tremolo.
Yeah.
It's
No, for sure. But you can't lose the basses. You can't lose the bassi, the cello basses, you know. Anyway, but I just that's a moment where it's just so powerful. And I tell the bassi, the cello's basses, like those three measures before D, that they just lean into that, and I tell everybody else, you gotta keep an ear to that rising line, and follow that rising line, and then listen to what comes after it, and make sure you can hear it, you know, just kind of keep things down a little bit, and that
you know, I just had a thought that this kind of reminds me too, is it the third symphony again, where it's like that you have this rising thing.
I'm not sure the part you're talking about.
I'm trying to remember. It's in the march. Is it the second movement of the Third Symphony that does that same idea?
The funeral march?
Where this you have this ramp up, and then you have this... and then you have this big chord.
It's right? At the end. It's right before the coda of the last movement, right?
That's what I'm thinking of, I think, yeah.
It just keeps going, yeah. It just keeps going. And it's right before...
There's like a couple of moments where this ends.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I know the story about that now.
I'm just thinking about the figuration of this.
Yeah, it's interesting how he writes rhythms that are similar to the Third Symphony.
Well, and there no, but it is in that other. Is it this one?
Oh shoot!
Stand by, radio.
I think it is right in the march, because we have the how's that go?
Is it in the basses?
Right.
Oh, that is in the second movie.
But
yeah.
But you have the build up, the same kind of build up. But yeah.
No.
That's the seventh
symphony.
Oh, we were just talking
about
that.
Yeah, we were. Yeah,
that's
the second movement.
It's okay. There we go.
I got my marches mixed up there.
Yeah, seven.
But it's the same. It's the same figuration idea here. Even though it's in a major key this time. Yeah. Sorry. Sorry.
No, it's okay.
Figuration.
No, you draw attention to an interesting link there, which is that they're all. They all have similar climactic moments
In
their
transitions. But I think with those staccato notes in the basses and stuff, I think, you know, there's that drive. There's this, like, it's like you're punching somebody in the chest with your finger, and you're just, like, getting a little more aggressive going into that.
Yeah, it eats at you.
You got to make that point, you know?
I love it.
And
he goes there.
Explosion. Yeah, there.
Yeah, he always goes there.
There you go.
It's just, he goes exactly where I want him to go.
Yeah.
Every time.
You feel it. You know it's coming. Yeah. There it is.
All right, good.
We go.
We're all just sort of sitting here like...
Fascinating.
I just want to think about this.
But, you know, you mentioned something about the seconds and the violas coming together and be kind of this engine moment. That's such a classical move because Haydn and Mozart all the time, seconds and violas, those inner voices are just constantly the ones churning this engine.
And here we have it
again. Just, it's like they're the ones that just sort of take over the motor to keep everything moving.
I have a question for you all about the ritardando a tempo moments.
Yeah.
In that secondary theme.
Yep.
When do you go into three?
Well, after ritard? When I did this before, I was in three for after the rest, after grand pause.
I imagine that would make it harder to make the ritard happen if they're not used to, if they're used to seeing you in three already. How do you make the ritard happen?
I just conduct bigger.
Well, that works.
Get the rebounds bigger, stretch.
So same question then. Do you start the retard where it's marked or a little bit before it?
I start thinking about it a measure ahead of time.
Well, I think that's a good idea. I think it's wise in any circumstance.
But I say thinking about it, like I let it drift into my arm. And I'm trying to remember what I did talk to them about this. Mm. I didn't like say let's do it a whole measure earlier, but I said... Let's start to sort of, like, position ourselves and, like, relax a little bit, you know, just to get ready for that. But I don't like a big ritardando there, just because I just don't think that's in the style, you know?
Yeah, how much retard? He doesn't say poco.
Dee-da-da-da-dee-da-da-da-da. Yeah, so I put it right where it's written. But maybe just slightly relaxed one measure before that.
Pull back on that, yeah.
Just a little bit, but... Yeah.
Okay.
Finesse it a little bit, but
I like a little bit more ritardando the second time.
Yeah, and see that to me is a really good musical choice because it, you know, provides a little bit of variety there.
I also like the tempo is somewhat gradual.
You kind of ramp up into it?
Yeah, as if it's not...
And then maybe back fully into odd tempo with it, where the tune comes back.
Exactly,
that makes sense. That's just good musical taste.
That's musicality right there.
There you go. Use your good sense. All right. Good deal. We're all in agreement on that. Okay, any other gems in this one? We got this fermatas coming up there.
The end of the first movement is cute.
Mm-hmm.
It's cute.
You know, bup, bup, bup. Bup, bup, bup. Boop, boop, boop.
Yeah.
Beep, 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 boop.
It is super beep, beep, ridiculously beep, playful. Boop,
boop. Beep, yeah. Beep. I really, this feels so much like Beethoven really reconnecting with Haydn and the jokey Haydn stuff.
It's very jokey,
You know?
This is, I think I completely agree with you on that. I think this really is a look back, just something fun.
And it has to be absolutely quiet. A real pianissimo. Yeah, just nothing. Yeah,
it's like
it's just smirking. Yeah. Beethoven just
so
like,
is he making fun of the Fifth Symphony here? Ba 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 ba.
I don't know. Could be.
I think this is Beethoven chuckling, which is something we don't often think about.
It also makes a really great link to the start of the second movement.
Yeah,
because we have bop 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 is the last thing we hear accompanies the dee da 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 dum melody of the first movement.
Mm-hmm.
Bop 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 bum, and then we have bop 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 bop. Yeah.
What a great little tune that is.
Yeah, and this one's also fun, full of fun and whimsies as well. Dynamic stuff. You know, the sudden, really loud.
Oh, I love that.
30-second notes or 64th
notes.
This
almost reminds me of like this is like some sort of comedic dance moment in some old timey, 19th century movie.
Yeah,
like they're just goofing around, and there's like there's the clown guy that just shows up. He's like
and everybody
else is like. That's sort of what I envisioned.
So you envisioned this thing like that was measured 25, like that's where the crazy clown comes in, or 23 and 25.
Yeah, but he's one of those like old, you know, Venetian Viennese kind of.
A bachazzo.
A Venetian Viennese.
Yes. A Venetian Viennese clown.
It's the best kind of Viennese.
Venetian mask, but he's a clown from whatever.
Fair enough. It's creepy clown. That's all we got.
It's not creepy.
He's a nice clown.
He's jovial.
A jolly clown.
It's like what, you know, what Till Eulenspiegel would have been.
Oh, okay. There you go. Oh, okay. All right. We're crossing composers now, confusingly. All right. Good. So, there was something I was going to say, but I totally lost my train of thought.
Letter A.
I threw you off with the creepy clown.
Yeah. Letter A, yeah, I love what he does with the rhythm. He turns it into a 3-4. A 3-8, actually. Yeah, I always have a hard time keeping track of where I am in this, so I finally had to just map it out and realize, oh, he's actually playing with the time quite a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, it gets a little dicey there. Some judicious phrase markings would be helpful there for sure to keep you on track.
Yes.
Yep. All right. Good. Creepy clowns.
Nah, it's not creepy.
Catholic school. That's the word on the second movement, right?
My favorite part of this symphony, the whole symphony, is the four letter B. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 measures. Where the clarinets and the bassoons begin the theme. And then the rest of the orchestra, basically, almost all the orchestra, echoes them a bar later.
Mm-hmm.
It does amazing things.
Yeah.
That is all.
It's good stuff. It's good stuff.
My favorite part of the whole symphony.
All right. It's a good moment. Good moment. All right. Good deal.
I can't tell you why, other than it's just awesome.
It speaks to you.
All right. Go listen to it.
When you were sitting there in Catholic school, you heard that moment, and something happened.
Yeah.
Something happened.
Yeah, I didn't feel as much Catholic guilt at that moment.
I felt relaxed.
Yeah.
Oh my god! Let's not even get into that. Oh my god, Matt, you and I have an interesting.
It's a real.
We've
thing.
Walked a similar path.
Indeed.
You and I have.
Yeah.
Yes, we have. All right. Okay. Third movement. Beat a dee da dee da.
For a long time, I thought that beat three was beat one.
Yep, yeah. Absolutely.
One and two and three. He changes note on beat three. He starts on beat three and then changes the note in beat three.
Mm-hmm.
And so really, when I learned the score, it really threw me for a loop.
Yeah, take that, Brahms.
Evidence for not learning, for not conducting to the music, but learning it by the score.
There you go. That's right. Can't go by feel.
You give beats one and two.
Pardon?
You give one and two.
One. I just give two. Two.
Okay.
Ba-da-da-da. I don't think they need extra one.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah, I agree.
Ba-da-dee-da-dee-da. Yeah, I think it's fine. Tricky movement at 45. The unrelenting triplet stuff in the cellos, poor cellos, keeping all that together. And then it's got to lock up with the woodwinds and the horns. Mm-hmm. And this is a thing. I don't know if you guys experience this with your ensembles too, but you know, you have to, a lot of times the winds can get a little bit behind, and it's a way of the sound production of the instrument, a little, you know, you've been using the immediacy of the sound is not as immediate as you can get with a string instrument sometimes, so you have to be a little bit ahead of it. So keeping the horns and the clarinets together with that relenting triplet stuff, it just takes a little bit of work, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's like chamber music at this point.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And to me, in terms of conducting, it's all business. It's just dry, keeping that pulse, keeping the cellos from rushing, keeping the winds from dragging, and just really being present there. But it's a you know, of this movement, this is obviously the spot we spend the most time rehearsing on, and it was just coordinating those the cellos, just
getting
the,
people to listen real hard to each other.
Yeah, and to not not to get in your little zone and to just be aware of what's going on. And the cello part's not easy. I mean, that's a little, can be a little tricky.
You know, it was marked solo in sources.
So just one, it was supposed to be just one cello?
It often meant like a soli, like a section solo.
Right.
But maybe he didn't. He did mean for one player here.
You think he did?
Maybe. I mean, it's virtuosic enough that it would work better.
I could
probably.
See,
I
and
mean,
you know what? Look at the instrumentation on it. Yeah. Like, you could do it as a solo.
And, you know, it could traditional trio, three instruments.
That's true.
How about that?
With a basso continuo.
The basso line?
Yeah. Wow. Ooh, wow. Well, it's not three because there's technically
three. Well, you're technically have two horns
playing, but it's the spirit of it.
Well, three groups of instruments.
Yeah.
A wind group,
I mean,
clarinet,
doesn't last more than that section.
No.
Because then the violin and
the viola. That
would
be an interesting contrast, though, if you did it that way.
I think it would be great.
For a trio section.
Interesting. So what's the scholarship on the likelihood that it was probably just one instrument?
No idea.
But you got the Baron-Rider. They don't have like some...
Yeah, I've already said everything that's in here.
Oh, you've given us the best information.
That's the extent of the research.
All right. Doctoral dissertation.
They have one good player. I don't know.
Yeah, I kind of like that.
Maybe they just couldn't get everybody to play it in all the triplets together, so they just cut it into one.
Yeah, but I mean, it's such a thin texture, even when the violins come in.
I think that would be a fun spot to just experiment with and see how it comes.
At the you very know, least, next time.
Depending on the size of the section, I might even just pare it down to four players.
Yeah.
Or three.
Yeah, you could maybe do just solo at 45 and then... in the second section of the trio, maybe bring in three more cello players.
Yeah, that would be interesting to hear that.
You could have the cellos play with the bass line.
You could.
It's probably in the same part.
Reinforce the bass line.
Okay. All right. Interesting stuff.
Yeah.
This is the kind of stuff that just, I don't know, gets me all excited.
I know. Now he's like, now when can we do this again?
I know, right?
Let's do it.
Yeah.
I know. Well, I've got
you're gonna do
four, five,
first,
and six.
Right? You said you're going to do five first next time we can get up and go, right?
Right, yeah. So I'm my planning is to do my Beethoven season whenever I can.
I'll do eight. How about that?
There you go. All right, we'll make it a tag team
Matthew's
effort.
Matthew's going to do nine.
Make it a tag team effort. All right, good. There you go. And super, super traditional just gives us a minuet da capo.
I'll lose the UPS man.
There you go. Gives us a minuet da capo, doesn't bother to write it out. Back to the old ways.
Right, which I think is even more evidence of we're looking back to what used to be.
He's going back to the high class.
Yeah, it's so interesting that he just decided to... See, that is also more evidence for what I was saying earlier. He was just done. He was tired. He's like, screw it, I'm just going to make it a da capo repeat.
Maybe he was super busy with other projects. And he was just like,
Maybe he was just feeling nostalgic.
I don't know what else he was writing right in this time period. But,
okay.
1812.
Okay. Oh, we got this big truck coming through here. Well, it's not that big, it's just loud.
The diesel engine. Gotta shift the second gear there. There you go.
Get it moving, there, friend. Okay. All right, good. And anything else? Are we ready to move on to the fourth group?
You know what it was? He was occupied. It was during the period of composition of this symphony, the eighth, that he wrote his famous letter to the unnamed immortal beloved.
Oh, my goodness.
So he was feeling good, though.
Yeah.
So here we have a very happy tune.
Happy Beethoven.
Yeah, he was occupied with other
By things. The way, according to Maynard Solomon biography, Immortal Beloved in the movie is not who it actually was.
No,
I think
we
talked about this before.
I read that book.
You read the Solomon biography?
Yeah, it's great.
It's a good one.
It's a great biography.
Yeah. He wrote one of Mozart, too.
I know. I haven't tackled that one yet.
Yeah, that's good, too.
That's next up, I think.
There you go. Yeah, you're Mr. Composer Biography.
I got to finish my Strauss one, and we can move on.
All right.
Richard, not Johann.
Hey. You want to learn about waltzes?
No.
Okay. Well, fine. Be that way. Okay. Anything else? Third movement, or you want to move on to the fourth?
I can go to the fourth.
Let's go to the fourth. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Now, these triplets. So remember, I was talking about when I was programming this, I was like, yes, yes, yes. And then I got to the fourth, and I'm like, oh, wow. That's a little spicy. But it just sounds a little fluffy. You know, so if you have a student or community orchestra and it doesn't quite come together, I mean, it's not the end of the world, but...
From a playing perspective, you're having them down by the tip, yeah?
Yeah.
Nice and short.
Yeah, I mean, the upper half, not enough right at the tip. But yeah, upper
half. Why not?
Huh?
Why not? I'm not sure you have enough control.
Yeah.
Too hard to control?
That's, yeah.
Keep it that quiet?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I don't remember exactly what we had him do. But
yeah, it's got to probably be, to make it sound off enough, probably it has to be like right at that balance point.
Yeah.
Like halfway up.
Yeah. Just above the balance point, yeah.
I don't know. Again. I want to look at that. I got to think about the Boeing.
Beyond that, just a little bit, but I'm not a violinist. So I'm...
Yeah, I mean, we all have to be careful. Yeah, that's right. Singer, brass players, talking about Boeings.
But nice and short.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And it's a whoa.
Wow.
All
right.
You just got dive bombed by a bunch of birds.
That must be a hawk around.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, right there.
Oh my goodness.
Is that a falcon? Is that
a bird of prey out here?
Yeah, he's right up there on the.
Yeah, that's the sharp-chinned hawk. It hangs out here.
I've seen him a few times
before. He's up on the power pole right there.
Oh, yeah.
All right. There we go.
Speaking of being outside in nature.
Yeah. That's right. You just never know.
There he goes.
Came close. I saw some feathers fluffing around.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Really okay, cool. Well, let's get back to Beethoven. Back to it. All right, there we go.
It was exciting.
That was. It was kind of scary for a second there.
That was almost a triplet rhythm, though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was. You know, that made me think of something. It's so fast that when you just use that little wrist action on the bow, it's going to be short. Yeah, it's going to work.
Yeah.
Larry's
well,
like,
the flute
and
the oboe, they're kind of little bird calls, so we can tie this in.
Yeah, but it's a spicy moment. You have a plan, and, you know, get it done. But we pulled it off, and I was happy with how it came out. But this opening section, beat it up, bah! I mean, it's just it's just so powerful. This again, this seems like more jokey stuff, right? It's just so soft. Beat it up
from three,
beat it up, boom.
Three P's to two F's.
Three P's.
That might be one of the largest jumps. Subito jumps in his.
I don't think he's had a
output.
Jump like that before.
That's not a big jump.
The only thing that could possibly be bigger is 3Ps to 3Fs, and that doesn't happen, right? Does it happen?
And Beethoven? I don't know.
This might be the biggest dynamic.
I think this is the biggest leap ever.
It seems like something McKeever would know, but maybe not.
You know what? He's not here.
He's not here to tell us?
He's not here. And Matt, if you're listening, how dare you? It's been too long, man.
We'll get him back.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So anyway, there's the big moment. It pickups to 18. Oh man, it's just, I don't know. Just so much energy in Beethoven.
Yeah,
even
is,
when he's
this,
in his classical
movement,
style.
For me, this movement is spring loaded.
Yeah,
that's how I look at this. It just kind of, you just wind it up and let it go.
Yep.
I love when he has sustaining instruments coming in before you expect. And then sort of doing something. So, for instance, measure 59. With the horns and the trumpets coming in on that lone D.
Mm-hmm.
And then crescendo to subito piano and pianissimo.
Yep.
Just a bar before you'd expect.
Something like that happened in the third symphony, too?
Probably.
The horns coming in early? I don't know.
It's just... Beethoven was the master of transition in all its forms, I think, from formal section to formal section, from phrase to phrase, from movement to movement. The guy knew how to link things.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, I look at him as like, he's like the master Lego guy.
The who?
The master Legos?
Oh.
Because they're all just little bits, right? They're just these motives that he just takes, and he just knows how to click them onto the right spots, and he creates this Lego sculpture, so to speak. Symphonic Lego sculpture.
Symphonic Legos.
So for those of you that are looking for somebody to sponsor your concerts.
There you go. When I explain form and structure, I'm going to use Legos from now on. That makes sense.
But it makes sense because he's just taking his little pieces and then he just clicks them together.
Boom, boom,
and then
boom,
boom, they work.
There it is.
You create this thing. But I was going to ask you, Larry, when you were talking about your string players with this piece, do you find this movement to be difficult in general because there's a lot of string action happening throughout the whole thing?
Not necessarily because there's a lot of string action. It's mostly kind of that opening theme.
They're pretty busy though throughout this.
Well, they are, but I think the workload is such that it's not super tiring, and it's not that long. I mean, this movement is just 8 minutes long.
The whole thing is pretty short.
Yeah, so I it didn't feel like we had an overload in terms of work, but you know. They tend not to complain, so maybe they felt overloaded and just were nice about it.
They're constantly busy, so
yeah, it's working all the time, and Another thing at letter A, when you get into the second theme group area, no slowing down here. Sometimes I like a little relaxation, you know, in these second theme areas, but not here. Here I want it just to keep going, and it's because of this the sextuplet quarter notes that come a few bars later. It's got to keep rolling, in my opinion. It's got to keep rolling. There's no room for relaxation there. Because of that rhythm that goes along there. So that to me would negate my normal tendency to slightly relax in those second theme areas. Okay, and then letter B, deconstructing and reconstruct, or it suddenly deconstructs, I should say that, and then he reconstructs it together.
It's kind of the theme of this symphony, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I know, just this beautiful building back up together.
Apart, put it back together.
Very, very, very lighthearted and playful.
Those eighths or sixteenths?
Those are eighth notes. Yeah.
Okay. Da, 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 da. My fault.
No. It's the original, in the beginning. Da, 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 da.
Oh,
da, da,
da. Right.
Yeah, but it's half. It's sort of half time.
Oh, yeah. Okay. What time? What's the time signature?
Two four.
Oh,
but it's cut time. It's cut time. All abreast. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. What is our metronome mark here at the beginning?
I've got
84 for a half whole note.
That's fast.
Yeah, it's fast.
That is a little unmanageable, I think, for many groups.
Oh yeah, we didn't go that fast.
No, it's hard.
There's one time where I'm like, I'm departing from the written.
Slower. That's at least 8 or 9 clicks slower.
Yeah. Yeah. And I did it in two. I didn't try and do it in one. I just did it in a very dry two. All right, good deal. And then just slowly building it up, and then breaks down at B. Da, 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 da. This long section of just slowly adding things, and the string parts going back and forth. It's just amazing of how much interest can be sustained over a long period of time with seemingly not a lot of action happening. Mm-hmm. Like when you just look at the page, it's like this is not particularly
it's very
active.
Little black ink.
Yeah, but it's just rich with what he does with his harmonic changes and stuff there. It's, I don't know. And he just gradually building it until we finally get back to letter D, and it's just this heroic return of the theme. But this long interval section in the middle. And it's incumbent upon the orchestra to bring out those changes and to bring out those color changes and the winds and the back and forth in the strings, making sure you have that energy there. But if you do what he wrote and you bring out the parts, you bring out the changes and the different lines, then it works. Mm. But you got to sustain that. And you got to keep the tempo up. That's again like I say, you can't let this thing relax here in the middle. Keeps the energy going.
After letter E,
yes,
when the second theme comes back in D flat major, I took a note here that this is very difficult for the first to pull this off. It's something about the key combined with the need to make it very legato, but also to be present, but not more than piano. It's very difficult, and it gets pitchy and hard to keep the sound going.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. I can see that. I remember having. Yeah, I remember that being an issue. Those crazy keys. Okay. Good. And then back to the deconstructed spot. Again, play this playful Haydn stuff at F. And then this part. This is 281. This is like, it's pianissimo, and all of a sudden this forte in the cello's bass is butter-dum. I mean, like, If anybody says like Beethoven didn't get something from Haydn, I mean this is I keep harping on it, but I find it just fascinating. This little weird jokey stuff.
It does sound just like Haydn.
Yeah, yep. It is. It's crazy. And
stop, start, stop, start. Red light, green light. Red light, green light. But, I mean, getting whiplash.
And again, this is the, like when we first read through it, and the cellos and basses got to that. They're like,
what?
Did we mess up? No, right? No.
Is there
no,
a line of music missing in our part?
It's intentionally supposed to be this.
Yeah.
Butter up.
Just you guys. Yeah. Just you.
Anyway, sorry. I'll stop singing. But I just love moments like this. It's just
this is awesome. Hard to conduct. It's hard to know where to put your attention.
It's tricky.
It's tricky. Who to give it to. There's so many different places you could go. It's hard to know it cold when you have so many choices to make.
Yeah. Yeah, you have a lot of business to take care of around 280 and 281.
Yeah, there is a lot of traffic copping.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the job. So how are you
for? Since we're at the Fermata Zill again, ask what are you with? How much time are we allowing for these?
Well, I mean, they're on rests, and
you're just doubling it?
It kind of depends on the hall, too. Like, if you... because the cello's basses, that butted up happens twice, and you want to maybe let that clear before you come back in with the second violins playing those half notes. But I think, you know, if you sit on it a little longer, it kind of makes it more jokey.
Does it make the joke more punchy?
It's all about... you got to play the room, you know?
I think that's true.
Play the crowd.
Having said that, I do like a longer second fermata.
Aha! He says a longer fermata. I like it.
Yeah, but the second one.
The second one.
Yeah, I think that's a wise choice to kind of like, you know...
I want that A in the seconds to kind of come out of nowhere.
Yeah. Second time after the little jokey section. Yeah, I like that. A little bit longer.
I should say also that I like to be in two before the fermatas, and then coming out of the fermatas, I like to switch into one.
I can see that. I just stayed in two. I tend to do that, but I can see how that makes sense. All right, good. And then
it just keeps going.
This ending. Now, yeah. Now, skipping a little bit towards the end, because the sun is setting and it's getting cold out here.
What I will say about this is I love pretty much everything Beethoven has ever done. Oh, that fits perfectly. Except for the ending of this.
Really?
I can't stand it.
Oh, it's...
Because it's one of those moments, and again, I think it's part of the joke, but I'm like, darn it, Beethoven, just freaking end the piece.
No, it's he was.
Is it the stuff at like 4:58 where you go, bee, bah, bah. Bobby, and it's like quiet.
Well, even before then,
Yeah. Okay, so here's what I do with this, because we talked about how I take this a little slower because the tempo is crazy. But to deal with this kind of like, to keep the energy going, I actually have added some tempo increases. The first tempo increase I give is at 386, and I start pushing the tempo there. And I keep it going. And then I do another tempo increase. Is it at letter I? Maybe. I'm not sure. I don't have that written in. I thought I did it at I. Maybe I just forgot to write it in there. And then I do another one at K. Bom, 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 beep. And then that quiet stuff is so weird. I mean, it's cool, but I like it fast. And I think that if you're not taking his... Or is it whole note equals 84 tempo in the beginning? Here, if you're under that tempo, it really doesn't make sense.
Okay.
So I'm pushing it at K, and then it provides a lot of cool energy at 480, where you finally come back to with that big ramp up to the end. Yeah. So that's how I think mitigates, because I agree with you. It's kind of an odd way to end it, and
I'm fine with it. It's just one of those things. I'm like, are we done yet? Are we done? Come on.
Drag
it out.
I think that's the point.
But I think it's part of the joke.
It is absolutely what you were saying before, where he just wants to poke and poke and poke. And this time, instead of like just poking, he's got a knife and he's like sticking you with the knife.
Like, yeah, it's like, you're right, at 482. Yeah. Bump, 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 bump.
It's dun, just dun, so, dun, 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 it's dun, so dun, over dun, the top. Dun, it's so.
And then bump, dun,
yeah.
Bump.
He does it again.
I want the audience to have to roll their eyes. This is musical
like
eye
how
roll.
Can we drag out a tonic chord any longer?
Yeah.
Well, let me show you.
Yeah. It's good. Yeah. It's just one big...
Do your analysis on this. You've got like 9 pages of just one chord.
Yeah.
He's having such a good time.
Yeah, I like it.
When I say I don't hate it. It just is like, oh my gosh.
I think it makes it fun and playful if you have the tempo going fast. So that's my argument for pushing it at the end, because I didn't do it in the original notated tempo.
I'm not sure I subscribe to that.
You don't think I would do that?
No, I think I want it to be persistently, obstinately steady.
Okay.
Just to drive the point home. Like, we're not
well,
going to
I don't do, like,
easier.
In a cello rondo, like, I bump it up.
Yeah.
And, like, I bump it up at K, and then I keep it steady.
Well, it's
so
still in a cello
rondo. It's not
rondo.
Like I go bump, 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 bump. It's not like I speed it up at the end.
That would be Jaws.
I do. It is steady on that. All those crazy endless tonic chords at the end. I do keep all those the same beat, so I don't speed up through that. But I've knocked that whole section up a notch.
I'll have to think about that. I'm curious how that comes across. Okay.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to listen to that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, final thoughts on this piece, gentlemen.
It's just fun.
Yeah.
It's just a fun, playful piece, and I really like that. And hearing that, you know, this is at the Immortal Beloved letter time, like, kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
It's like, his heart's and his brain is in a good spot right now.
It's very light. Almost light. Yeah, it is light. It's just, this to me feels ambiguous, the symphony. It's yeah, there's a lot of joking, but joking aside, there's depth as well.
There is.
And it's just so out of character for what comes before and after that it's just such an interesting addition to his output at this particular moment in time.
Yeah, and I like the throwback to Haydn. I really do. It's fun.
What about you, Larry?
Well, I think I agree. I associate myself with all these comments, and
You're welcome.
I think it's again, it's a gem that should get used played more often, and maybe you should pair it with some Haydn, pair like on a concert, pair it with a late Haydn symphony or something like that,
or like the drum symphony,
the drum roll symphony. Yeah. Yeah, it'd be good. But, you know, or maybe that's too much. Maybe you want more diversity in your concert. But I think maybe, you know, just to sort of see that connection there might
be
kind of fun.
Mozart's musical joke.
Huh?
You could do Mozart's musical joke. That's a good little piece.
There you go. A joke concert. Well, anyway, I think it's a wonderful piece. I'm glad I did it. You know, recommend it to everybody. So, all right. Well, let's wrap this show up, guys.
Let's get this on the road.
Yeah, it's getting a little chilly. The sun is dipping in the sky. But thank you so much again, Matt, for having us. This is always a pleasure to be with you. Brandon, thank you again for being with us.
Yeah,
and
anytime.
You'll join us for our final installment, which will be the Ninth Symphony coming up. And we'll probably have that one right before the birthday. So his birthday, well, he was baptized, I think, on December 17th.
So he was born
a couple days ahead of that.
Oh, days are okay.
Yeah, that's the whole discrepancy with the last name issue and am I royalty, am I not?
I don't think he is.
I don't think he is either. He thinks he is.
Now, there you go.
That's a whole other topic.
We should bring Ashkan on for that, Joe, because he is royalty.
Is he?
Yeah, part of his name is like a royal Persian name or something, his last name.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Oh, my. Well, that's interesting.
Not my family.
No, me neither. Although it could be related to Saint-Saëns.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. I'm related to a former British House of Commons member at the time of the English Civil War.
Oh,
so I got
traitor.
That going for me. Yeah, I've got a traitor to the crown.
Yeah, you
in,
are.
In the family tree.
Are you part of the Roundheads? Or are you part
Roundhead.
Of the, okay.
Yeah, Roundhead. He was a parliamentarian.
Wow.
And he was one of Cromwell's men.
How about that?
Yep.
Okay.
There you go.
Well, then the hat is fitting.
It's not round enough.
People can't see the hat I'm wearing. I'm wearing my round. I kind of look like a pilgrim.
You look sort of like Guy Fawkes.
It is kind of a Guy Fawkes hat. I like that.
Well, I'm not going to blow up Parliament.
Do you
Don't
remember?
Worry.
That was what we already missed that by the last.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, we did. We missed that one.
We are quickly devolving. We should
probably stop. Okay, we're going to put a fork in this at this point.
Put a fermata here.
There we go. A fermata on the rest.
Indeed,
we're out. So thanks again, gentlemen, for joining us. Thank you for listening. If you like the show, hit subscribe, and you'll always be in touch with what we do. And until next time, this has been Conductor's Brew with Larry, Matt,
and crew,
which today is Brandon Horrocks. Thanks, everybody. See you next time.
Cheers.
Bye.